my point from the beginning about all of these allegations against Brett Kavanaugh is that there's not been a robust, a meaningful investigation. There's not been an investigation with the level of attention that normally would occur around these kinds of allegations, and especially related to the subject at hand, which is the appropriateness of this individual serving on the highest court of our land for a lifetime of appointment.
California Senator Kamala Harris talking with NPR today about her call to impeach Brett Kavanaugh. At least four other presidential candidates are joining her. And this comes in response to a story published over the weekend in the New York Times, an excerpt from a new book about Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing. The book corroborates a sexual assault allegation against Kavanaugh while he was a student at Yale and details a second previously unreported assault allegation. It's Monday, so that means our legal, Jessica Levinson, is here. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School. Hi.
Hi.
Well, what would it take to impeach a Supreme Court justice?
A lot of political will, which we do not have.
Clearly.
So to take this question more seriously, what does it take to impeach any federal official? It takes the same process that we've been talking about when it comes to the president. Mm-hmm. So you would have to have essentially the House Judiciary Committee to investigate the allegations. Then you would refer articles of impeachment to the full House. You would have a vote by a simple majority of the House. Yes, we're going to impeach. What's the standard? It's something totally undefinable, like high crimes and misdemeanors. What does it mean? Who knows? And then we would go on to the Senate, where you would need a conviction by, wait for it, 2/3 of the mm-hmm. Senate before you're removed. How often has a Supreme Court justice ever been impeached? Once in 1805, and he was acquitted by the Senate.
Oh, okay.
Is this going to happen? No.
Even you mentioned the House Judiciary Committee, even the chair, Jerry Nadler, seemed to say, no, this is not going to happen. He said today, we are too busy impeaching the president to take this up.
If ever there was a statement that really encapsulated America in 2019, it's the head of the Judiciary Committee saying, we're going to need you to wait in the impeachment line because we simply don't have time for you right now.
But what does this mean in general for the credibility of the Supreme Court, of Kavanaugh in particular? Does this cloud, you know, just cloud the reputation, make it muddier, make it more partisan than it already was?
So, yes, I mean, I think that his confirmation hearings, frankly, already did that to the extent that, you know, it looked like there wasn't a real investigation into these allegations. It looked like it was already decided how people were going to vote just based on whether there was a D behind their name or an R behind their name. And so does this hurt the credibility of the court? Yes, because again, when we're talking about federal judges, they have a lifetime appointment. The only way we could remove them is the process we just talked about, impeachment and then conviction in the Senate.
Well, he could resign.
He could resign, but the only way we can force them out.
Mm-hmm.
And so why do we have that lifetime appointment? The idea is you're not supposed to be susceptible to political pressure. You're supposed to be above the fray. You just look at facts, you look at the law, and you make a decision not based on what's popular in the next election. But the credibility of the court depends on this idea that they are above politics, that they are not just politicians in robes. And Kavanaugh did, I think, a disastrous job of trying to show that in his confirmation hearings. This just frankly feeds the narrative that we've already been listening and watching.
And then you have President Trump weighing in, say Kavanaugh should sue for libel. Is that possible?
It's possible, but he won't do it because if you sue for libel, one of the things you have to show a statement was made, we're there. You have to show it harmed his reputation. Yes, check mark. You have to show it was a false statement. Now, I do not think Justice Kavanaugh is going to want to try and have basically a full litigation as to whether or not these allegations were false or not. That's why, for instance, we saw defamation suits against President Trump when mm-hmm. he denied having affairs or paid people off. It's a backdoor way of trying to litigate whether or not the allegations were true or not.
And he probably just wants it all to go away, not more attention to be focused on this.
I think that he would love for the story to, I think he would love for another story to take this over and for this to be essentially just a footnote in is already troubled confirmation.
Okay, let's turn to another story now. A federal appeals court has revived one of the emolument suits against President Trump. What did the court say?
So this is a case that was filed by Crew, which is a nonprofit, and they sued and they said the president is violating the emoluments clause because he didn't divest himself of his businesses. He didn't put things in a blind trust. And that members of foreign governments are staying at his hotels or patronizing his restaurants, et cetera. And therefore, foreign governments are giving him money, and that's violating the emoluments clause. It was thrown out because a district court judge way back in December 2017, for those listeners who remember when we talked about this particular suit before, was thrown out because the judge said, you don't have standing. Mm-hmm. We've talked about standing. Yes. Frankly, a surprising amount, essentially saying you weren't hurt enough. You're not the right people to bring this case. What the Court of Appeals said in this decision from late last week wasn't, yes, there's a violation of the emoluments. It was, no, they've alleged enough to keep going in their suit. They do have standing. They can continue. So we could see an appeal just of this standing issue. Again, this isn't the merits of whether or not there's an emoluments clause violation. We still don't know who exactly can bring those suits, what exactly an emolument is, and how exactly you can violate the clause.
Okay, but we will be talking about that a lot.
Yes.
Coming up in the future.
Well, there
in the
are
near and the far future,
18,000 different emolument suits. So, yes, we
exactly.
will be talking about it.
Okay, finally, let's talk about here in California. Governor Gavin Newsom has a bill on his desk that would ban political parties from having misleading names. And this is aimed squarely at the American Independent Party. Tell us more about that.
So I was actually just talking about with someone who works at Loyola Law School, and he said, I'm registered independent. And I said, hold on one second. Are you registered American independent? And he said, yes, I'm registered independent. He thought that he was registered as what California calls either no party preference or declines a state.
Uh-huh.
The American Independent Party is a far right party. It is not registering as a member of no party. It is a party. It is a third party. And the LA Times did a great investigation that indicated many people who are part of that party have no desire to affiliate with it. They've just been confused.
But this bill seems a little vague and might violate the First Amendment.
This bill seems a little vague. People definitely have a right to, you know, political parties have a right to name themselves, to associate with who they want to. But the state has a right to prevent misleading parties. So we've actually talked about this when it comes to the law to say you can't get on the ballot unless you release your tax returns for the primary election, for presidential primary election. Mm-hmm. So states have an interest in who appears on the ballot, what the party's name is, etc. If it truly is this misleading, then I think it could be a constitutional rule. We'll see if Governor Newsom signs it.
Okay, we will. Jessica Levinson teaches law at Loyola Law School, and she's here every Monday as our regular Legal Eagle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, all UCs and state universities would have to offer the abortion pill to students if they want it. That's in another bill sitting on Governor Newsom's desk. He hasn't said if he'll sign it, but he indicated he would have signed a previous version that Governor Brown vetoed. Well, here to tell us more about the bill, what it would do, is Dr. Julie Cantor. She teaches health law and reproductive rights at UCLA. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Great to have you. Okay. So Senator Connie Leyva authored this bill, and she said in a statement that the bill prevents students from having to, quote, choose between delaying important medical care and having to travel long distances or miss classes or work. So tell us more about what her intent is with this bill.
Right. So we always look to the language of the bill itself. And what we have here is language that says abortion care is a constitutional right and part of women's reproductive health care. Mm-hmm. So we start there. And what the concern was that people who have made that decision to terminate need access to abortion care, and medication abortion is something that they can have and that they can take advantage of. Now, if you aren't able to have that on campus, you may need to travel. You may need to travel long distances. There may be, depending on where you are, some video healthcare options, but the intent here is to make it to make women who are on campuses able to access abortion earlier in the care, and that it's not burdensome, that it's something that they can have just when they go to the normal student clinic, as opposed to finding a different provider or an outside clinic.
And then, but don't these drugs have to be administered under the guidance of a healthcare provider who knows something about this procedure?
And so that would be, you're absolutely right there, that they generally need to be discussed with a healthcare provider in terms of the options, and that the way some of these medication abortions, and there are different procedures that and different medication regimes and regimens that can be used. But yes, generally speaking, one of the standards of care is to observe that first pill being taken, so you can be sure that the person who consented to the procedure is actually the person who's now using the medicine. So that's one thing that happens. And the bill talks about forming a commission and having a specific fund. And so all of these kinds of issues about the standard of care and what form it'll actually take are things that need to be worked out between now and when the bill is saying that this needs to be in place. And that date is January 1st of 2023. Okay, so we have some time. Exactly.
But they would definitely have to have people in place on campus who can administer this.
Correct. And the idea here is this also travels a bit on the heels of an earlier law a few years back where medication abortion was expanded in terms of who's legally authorized to allow a medication abortion and be able to prescribe that and be able to oversee that. So we have in California the ability of a number of clinicians, not only physicians, but nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and certified nurse midwives. So those are the clinicians who are going to be in place, and those are the people who are going to need to provide that care in these student health centers. And that's the key, that we are able to now, if you're a student on campus, that you're able to access this option, which is a legal and a safe option for people. And the earlier that they can have it in their pregnancy that they want to discontinue, the better in terms of healthcare and outcomes. That is now something that they can have while they're on campus. And the idea is that they don't have to miss work or class or have exorbitant costs in terms of time or energy. And they can also preserve some measure of privacy.
Yeah. So I wonder if anti-abortion folks are upset about this and saying one argument I could foresee is that these are public universities with public dollars and these are tax dollars going to support this procedure that I am not in favor of.
Exactly. And that's something that I did see as an argument. But if you actually read the text of the bill, it's not applicable. And it's always important to check the law to see what we're arguing about. So if you look at the bill itself and you read the language of the bill, and if you want to litigate it, that's where you're going to go. The bill is providing a fund that it calls the College Student Health Center Sexual and Reproductive Health Preparation Fund, which is funded by private monies. So it's already something that the people who have voted on this and who've written the bill in the legislature, that they've anticipated that argument and they've cordoned off these funds. So this is a private fundraise and it's private monies, and they actually have language in the bill saying that we are, as a legislature, we're having no discussion about whether you're required to use public funds. In fact, we're providing these private funds for you. So that would seem to preclude that argument entirely.
Although you could say they are on a public property that is supported by public funds. They could say that everything else around there is publicly supported. Maybe the salary of the healthcare worker. I don't know.
You could. And those are arguments that definitely come up in what people have termed this conscientious objection to healthcare and to abortion specifically, and in other instances. And that's something that we'll probably have to get into the nuances of it. It seems like they would have a difficult battle there and an uphill battle. But to be sure, under the Bush administration, George W. Bush, there was that separation with cloning and stem cell research. Mm-hmm. And so there was an issue where people who were doing stem cell research had to sort of recreate their entire lab because public funds could not be used for that particular form of research during that particular mm-hmm. era. So it's not... it's not a crazy, unfounded argument. I just don't know that it's going to have legs in this jurisdiction and under this bill.
And there's also the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits federal funds from paying for abortions.
Exactly. So that's in place. And I know that that's come up in the presidential debates lately, should that continue. But as it is now, there are no federal funds that are involved in this situation.
Why did Governor Brown veto it?
You know, it's a good question, and it's one that doesn't come up in the language here that's in the bill or in the discussion of it. So I'm not exactly sure, and I definitely could get back to you on that. But it's a question of what did the language say at the time and mm-hmm. what were the interests at stake? And, it could be that looking back, perhaps it was an issue of funding. I'd have to check to be sure. But that could, because you're raising it as certainly an issue that would come up, perhaps that was the one that they needed to work on. And now they have actually a number. They have $10,290,000 in private money that they have raised and are talking about in this bill. So they have a very specific number. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if that was the sticking point previously.
And again, we don't know whether or not Governor Newsom will sign this particular version.
Correct. We do not know. It's pending. We'll watch it.
All right. Dr. Julie Cantor, she's a physician and a lawyer. She teaches health law and reproductive rights at UCLA. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
Okay, this is the final week of the KCRW UnDrive fundraiser. This is our big, big push to get you guys to join or renew your membership because we just come to you twice a year and we're not interrupting our programming at all. We have some great thank you gifts and you can enter the sweepstakes for the new iPhone 11. I guess it's 11 at this point. I've kind of lost track. But anyway, you could win one of those if you join today. KCRW.com/join. And thank you for your support. Coming up, why tomorrow's election in Israel could end hopes for a two-state solution. That story next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Israeli voters head to the polls tomorrow. It is the second general election this year after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu failed to form a governing coalition this spring. Netanyahu is fighting for his political future, and to do that, he is increasingly turning ever more rightward. He's vowed to annex all the settlements in the predominantly Palestinian West Bank. He's also embracing and forging ties with right-wing leaders around the world, including Russian President Vladimir Putin. Aaron David Miller joins me now, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Hi there.
Hey, how are you, Madeline?
Great, thanks. Okay, second election in 6 months. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that the driving force in this election is not the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or anything that Mr. Netanyahu said. It reflects a certain personal and political chaos in the Israeli political establishment, which has seen a number of firsts. The first do-over election within 5 months of the previous one, the first election in April, where the president of the State of Israel turned to the candidate that most of the parties recommended to form a government, and yet 6 weeks after he tried, he couldn't do so. So you've got a degree of, in many respects, as consequential and as fateful as this election is, from the standpoint of the issues involved, the motivation for people's voting, you could easily argue, and the Israeli chattering classes have, that this is, to borrow a Seinfeld trope, in many respects, a show about nothing. This is a result of the fact that the Prime Minister of Israel, the longest governing Prime Minister in the history of the state, having surpassed Ben-Gurion in July, could not manage, in part because his erstwhile former ally, Mr. Lieberman, withheld the 5 seats he needed to form a government. And rather than go to a national unity government, Mr. Netanyahu chose to go to new elections and got 100 Israeli members of Knesset to vote for new elections, largely in order to avoid what he fears most, which is not the loss of the election, but the loss of the election and a formal indictment, which could see him tried and even imprisoned if he's convicted. So this is, in many respects, a show about me, figuratively speaking.
So these are corruption charges. And even if he does win re-election tomorrow, could he still be indicted on these corruption charges?
No, if he wins, if he crosses the 60-seat barrier and gets even 61, he will form a narrow right-wing government, which will allow him to gain and secure parliamentary immunity. The Supreme Court might try to intercede in order to overturn that, but Mr. Netanyahu, with that Knesset majority, could amend the basic law, which would make it virtually impossible, even for the high court, to intercede. So what's at stake here? Yes, the peace process is important, but what's at stake here also is the issue of Israeli governance, Israeli democracy, and respect for minority rights.
And the rule of law, really.
Yeah. Yes. Forgive me. I should have put that at the top of the list. And the rule of law.
But so what about this promise on his part to annex the settlements in the West Bank? Is that just show? Because he said that before. But would he go ahead and do it?
He has. And the discreet statement that he made was to annex the Jordan Valley. And it's actually quite interesting. You're quite right. He's made statements before, although not in as close proximity to an election that will determine his political and even fate and even his freedom. He made a discreet comment about the Jordan Valley, which he's made before. That's 30% of the West Bank. There are roughly 11,000 Israelis living there, 65,000 Palestinians, two dozen plus Israeli settlements. And I suspect that if, in fact, he attains that majority, whether or not he moves to formally introduce legislation that would declare sovereignty over the Jordan Valley, he's picked an issue on which most Israelis, including his primary opponent, Mr. Gantz, has essentially said the Israelis cannot withdraw from the Jordan Valley. Gantz hasn't talked about annexation. But Mr. Netanyahu is well within the Israeli consensus, not so much on the settlements, on the Jordan Valley. He's reflected what has become more or less a mainstream Israeli position. It's quite clever, frankly, on his part, because Mr. Gantz has not and will not challenge him on this.
Any chance that he could lose, Netanyahu?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the problem, Madeline, is that this is a do-over election. And in an Israeli political history, there's no precedent for a passage of 5 months and another election. And the answer is yes. If the Arabs, 120 seats in the Knesset, it's proportional representation. If the Arabs turn out in the numbers that they turned out in 2015, 60%+, in the last election, they turned out in only 49%. If they turn out in 60 to 70%, he could lose. If the center left, the Labor Party, the party that governed Israel for the first 25 years of its independence, which has now shrunk to 6 seats, which is extraordinary to me, if Labor and Barak's party do better, if Mr. Gantz, a cross between, according to the Israeli pundits, between Clint Eastwood and the late Prime Minister Rabin, who's run a very low-profile kind of apolitical campaign, he's not a politician, if he does well, absolutely, you could create a situation where Mr. Gantz could and his party could actually gain fewer seats than Mr. Netanyahu, at least in his party, and still look at a situation where he might have an opportunity to put together a government. So we're all over the parking lot on this,
right?
And I wouldn't want to make any predictions.
But what you're saying is it does hinge on getting out the Arab vote, where in the last election, they didn't seem very enthusiastic about voting.
No, well,
what would change now?
They have a joint list, which is why they did so well and polling, I think, at an all-time high of 13 seats. They may well be motivated. Mr. Netanyahu has tried to do everything possible to keep them from the polls, including charging fraud, including trying to put cameras in the vote at the polling booths in an effort to discourage them from participating. That's one factor, and it's a very important factor. We haven't mentioned Mr. Lieberman, who was the reason, frankly, that you and I were even having this conversation, because we had Mr. Lieberman back in April, who is part of the right of center coalition. Had he given Mr. Netanyahu his 5 seats, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Mm-hmm. But he denied him those seats because he has, I think, turned on his former ally. He's feeling betrayed, and also he's feeling that he's found an issue, which is the secularization of Israeli political life. And Mr. Lieberman is banking on the fact that there are many Israelis who resent the fact that the Orthodox, the ultra-Orthodox, are not compelled to do military service. He's riding that wave. The more seats Lieberman gets, the fewer Mr. Netanyahu is going to get. So
okay.
I would be really hesitant to predict. I would only say this to you, that since 1977, there have been 14 elections in Israel's history. Likud has won 10 of them. Likud's opponents 3, and there's been 1 tie. So that the trend line here is that Israel has moved clearly to the right for political reasons, for demographic reasons, for reasons that have to do with Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon, Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, the importance of security, and those prime ministers that have embodied security. But when Likud has lost twice during that period, of the 3 times, they lost in 92 to a former chief of staff, Mr. Rabin, and they lost in 99 to a former chief of staff, Ehud Barak. And guess what? Benny Gantz is a former chief of staff. So
okay.
We'll see.
We're going to have to leave it there, but thank you. Fascinating discussion, and who knows what's going to happen tomorrow. Aaron David Miller from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks.
Thank you, Helen. Bye-bye.
Coming up, the biting wit of Texas columnist Molly Ivins.
She wrote about a congressman in Dallas that if his IQ slips any lower, we'll have to water him twice a day. So she got hate mail and she got fan mail.
A new documentary celebrates the life of Molly Ivins next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Columnist Molly Ivins pretty much said whatever she wanted about powerful people, Vice President Dan Quayle.
I must tell you honestly, I traveled with him during the 88 campaign. I found him dumber than advertised. Really horrifying thought, but I honestly think if you put that man's brain in a bumblebee, it would fly backwards.
Presidential candidate Pat Buchanan.
I know that many of you did not care for the tenor of Pat's speech at the Republican convention. I personally think it probably sounded better in the original German.
Newt Gingrich.
What's your take on Newt?
You speak of the trap-dodging, dope-smoking, deadbeat dad who divorced his dying wife?
Molly Ivins had a syndicated column carried by hundreds of newspapers where she would take an axe to political hypocrisy, all in her down-home Texas twang. She died of cancer in 2007. She was 62 years old. Well, now Molly Ivins is the subject of a new documentary. It's called Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins, and it's directed by my next guest, Janice Engel, who's here in the studio with me. Hi.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me,
Well,
Madeline.
It's great to have you. So Molly Ivins, she really was a larger-than-life character in many ways. And physically, she was quite imposing, right? She was 6 feet tall?
She was 6 feet tall, flaming red hair, beautiful blue-green eyes. She was actually incredibly striking, but she was truly, literally larger than life.
Yeah. How did she begin her larger-than-life life?
Well, she started out, actually, she was born in California. A lot of people don't know that, in Monterey. But as an infant, her parents moved to Houston, Texas, and her father started his climb up the oil and gas business. And she grew up in Houston in River Oaks. Mm.
Which is a fancy suburb.
Very Tony area of Houston.
Yeah. And her dad was very conservative. He ran an oil and gas company.
Yeah, he was general counsel of Tenneco Inc. And he was one of the power brokers in that business at that time. And so Molly came up that way. She went to private school at St. John's. She then went to Smith. She's third generation Smithy. Her mother went to Smith and her grandmother went to Smith. And as she likes to say, you don't get more WASP than that.
Well, did she speak differently in those days than she did in her later years?
Yes, she absolutely did. From what her pals told me who grew up with her, and they said when Molly arrived at St. John's around the eighth grade, they knew a really smart girl had entered the class. She was very imposing, and she would look down her nose at her girlfriends, who she thought were really silly. She was very mature and very well-read. And she was a goody two-shoes, and they nicknamed her Mature Mother Molly.
Oh, gosh.
Which I think is hilarious.
Right, which she doesn't come across as in her public life at all.
Not at all.
Yeah. But so I'm wondering how much of that her persona was crafted to be this kind of Texas broad who would say what was on her mind and cut people into smithereens. Like, how much of that was her? How much of it was crafted?
Well, you asked me if she talked like a Texan, and I'm sure when she was in high school and she was going to Paris and she went to Smith. No, she spoke, she was a Smithy.
Yeah.
But she definitely crafted the persona.
Yeah. And what she wrote was pretty much all liberal. She was plain spoken, obviously, but she decided not to do the typical journalist thing, which is get both sides, report it down the middle, or try to report it down the middle. She said, no, I believe this, and this is what I'm going to talk about.
Well, Molly did come up as a, you know, a wonk and a real journalist. And she, you know, you're taught in journalism school to cover all sides of the story. And she actually told a story about, you know, what real journalism is when you have a car crash or something, you have to get all six sides of the story and present all sides of it. And she did that. She did that at the Houston Chronicle. She did that at the Minneapolis Star Tribune. She did that at the New York Times. That's a whole other story.
Yeah, which we'll get into.
We'll get into. But she came back to Texas, and when she was given free rein to be a columnist, then she could write whatever she wanted and say whatever she wanted. And Molly said, you know, I let my readers know where I stand, and they can take that with a grain of salt or a pound of salt, depending on their preference.
Let's hear her talking about how she began covering the Texas state legislature.
When I first started writing about these bozos, and I'd say something in the Texas Observer, like, you know, Representative so-and-so runs on all fours and has the IQ of an adolescent pissant. And I'd wait for him to come by with a horse whip. And all that ever happened was I'd see him in the Capitol the next day and they'd say, baby, you put my name in your paper.
Well, so she was trailblazing. She was one of the only women covering the legislature, which didn't have a lot of women in it.
Molly broke the glass ceiling. She was hired in her early 20s with Kay Northcutt to be the two women running the only liberal newspaper or magazine in the South, much less the United States. And they did it for 6 years. Her bailiwick was speaking truth to power, standing up for those who don't have a say. You know, it's about who's getting screwed and who's doing the screwing. And she would go after stupidity. The other thing I will say is that everybody was, you know, big drinkers. And it's no, you know, secret. Molly was an alcoholic. She was high functioning. And, you know, drinking beer was, you know, the entry into the, you know, that world. You had, she could drink every guy under the table. She was 6 foot tall. She was big bone. She had an amazing constitution. She remembered everything they told her. I heard stories that
she would go drinking with them.
Yeah.
And they would, their, I don't know, their tongues would be loosened.
And that's how she would get her bits, and she would put it in there. And they didn't care if she wrote something bad about you. She wrote something good about you. It meant that she, you know, you were worth something because you were in her column, you know, even in her column, in her articles at the Texas Observer. It meant you were worth writing about.
Yeah. Well, how was she received? Because Texas, famously conservative state, she's famous liberal writing these columns. How did she gain so much power?
Well, they loved her. It was like a badge of honor to be in her column. And of course, when she became a columnist and she then could really go to town, she wrote about a congressman in Dallas that if his IQ slips any lower, we'll have to water him twice a day. So she got hate mail and she got fan mail. It was always both. It was always even. And her paper, even though people said, I'm going to cancel my subscription and da da da, her paper stood behind her, the Dallas Times Herald, and they took out billboards all over Dallas, Texas that said, Molly Ivins can't say that, can she? And that became the title of her first book, which is a collection of some of her funniest and most spot on columns. And it was a New York Times bestseller, and it stayed on the number one spot for, I mean, months and months and months and months.
Well, speaking of the New York Times, she didn't do so well there. in regards to her staying power, I don't think she fit in particularly well there.
No, she couldn't fit. They hired her for the Texas Iconoclast. They hired her for her voice, and they fired her for her voice. They edited out her voice completely.
Here she is talking about one instance of when that happened.
I made a feature story from out west that a fellow had a beer gut that belonged in the Smithsonian. Turned up the next day in the New York Times as a man with a protuberant abdomen. Which I felt did not have the same ring.
And so the editor at the time, Abe Rosenthal, really didn't like her tone and the way she wrote.
No, Abe Rosenthal was a true, you know, patriarchal figure, my way or the highway. And no, and he felt that she was not respecting the Times, that she had not the proper respect. She walked around barefoot. She wore work shirts and, you know, jeans, and she had her dog. And, you know, every time they just tried to put her in a box. The New York Times, they're still trying to. They're always trying to put Molly into. They want her to be something she's not.
Mm-hmm. So she got out of there and went back to Texas.
Yeah, she went back to Texas, to which she knew and she loved. And that is where she became the Molly Ivins.
And she was so powerful because she was syndicated nationwide, for one. And also, politicians read her columns. Bill Clinton, when he was president, he read her and he would call her up and talk to her. And really interesting moment you have in the film where she talks about how disappointed she is in him when he signs the welfare reform bill.
She was livid. She was in a rage. And that footage is amazing. My producing partner, Carlisle Vandervoort, found it. It's incredible. Molly looks like she's been on a bender. And it's the next morning. It was at the Plaza Hotel in New York. And she just let it rip. She was so angry. She felt betrayed by him. And she sat out that presidential race. She voted in the down ballot, but she sat out that presidential race. And for Molly Ivins to sit out a major race, that's a big statement.
The 96 race?
Yeah, it was the 96 race. She was so angry at him. Mm.
So Molly, as you say, was a drinker, an alcoholic, a smoker, and she had breast cancer and died relatively young.
62,
yeah. And I guess, you know, that's, you look at these, that is tragically young for her life to be cut short. She lived it to the fullest, obviously. Did she ever regret, I don't know, all the drinking, all the smoking, not taking care of herself? Or was that just part of the larger-than-life Molly Ivins?
Well, so Molly was, you know, passed when I started this project. But in talking to her friends and things that became revealed, you know, when Molly got first bout of cancer, you know, she didn't get a mammogram for 3 years. And then her column was to women, go, period, get, period, you know, every, mm-hmm. every word, period, period, the damn mammogram, done. She didn't take care of herself. She would clean up for a time. She would go to drunk school. She called it drunk school. She and Ann Richards back in the day. But she just was a hardcore drinker because she could. And that was the way. That's Texas, you know, mm-hmm. also, you know, roadie. You take a roadie in the cup, in the car. But she, when she got the first bout of cancer, her friend said, aren't you going to quit drinking? Aren't you going to quit smoking? She said, quit the only things I love. I got cancer. Are you crazy? I'm not going to do that. But then when she really had another bout and then another bout, and then there were a couple of really bad deaths, and she got walloped and she was drinking more and telling Betsy Moon, her chief of staff, she was drinking less. And she was really ready to off herself. And her friends reached in and they did an intervention with the help of the late Ann Richards. And she went to rehab. And when she detoxed in rehab and she came back, she got literally a month or two later diagnosed the cancer was back. And Molly made a decision. She had 2 years left to stay sober. When you're given a death sentence like that, why would you stay sober?
Yeah.
Molly, who could speak truth to power, decided to face her own truth at the end of her life and go out clear-headed. And her brother Andy told me, he passed away 3 weeks after we interviewed him.
Oh, wow.
Also of cancer at the age of 64. The chemo killed him. But Andy told me that the thing Molly wanted everybody to know at her memorial, the thing she was most proud of, was that she got sober in the last 18 months of her life.
Well, it does make you wonder what she would be saying today. And we miss her voice.
We really miss her voice.
Janice Engel, director of the documentary Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. It's in theaters now. Janice, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline. I loved being here.
And also here, Steve Chiotakis, welcome back.
Thank you.
Tell us about Greater LA at one.
Well, speaking of hell, you know, being on the front lines of a wildfire, not fun for fire crews, where it can often be 115 degrees outside and especially a lot hotter when you're trying to battle a blaze. You got all that weight on you.
Yeah.
So we're going to go on those front lines and actually the wildfire training as well coming up on Greater LA in just a few minutes.
Okay, well, do not miss it. We are in the final week of our UnDrive fun drive. I like to do that, a little rhyming there, sort of rhyming. And we really need you, if you've been on the fence, to get off the fence and become a member or renew your membership or throw us a few extra bucks. We have some great incentives today, including you could win a new Apple iPhone 11, lots of other sweepstakes, lots of other thank you gifts, but it's really important that you come in and join us because this is how we stay on the air, no joke. KCRW.com/join. Coming up, we'll remember Rick Ocasek of The Cars. That's next on Press Play. I don't mind coming here, wasting all my time. 'Cause when you're standing oh so near, I kinda lose my mind. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Life's the same. I'm moving in stereo. Life's the same, except for my shoes. Life's the same. You're shaking like tremolo. Life's the same. It's all inside you. Rick Ocasek, singer and guitarist for The Cars, was found dead in his New York home over the weekend. He was a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, a radio hit machine, and a producer for bands like Bad Brains, Weezer, Bad Religion, no doubt. Here to remember Rick Ocasek's career is KCRW's music guru, Eric J. Lawrence. Hey there.
Hi.
Well, first of all, I was surprised to learn that he was as old as he was, 70 or 75, depending on the report.
Right.
So he had been around a long time before he started The Cars.
He is a bit of a patron saint for the late bloomers. He had been dabbling with music for quite some time, but hadn't really sort of, coalesced into a band project that really sort of cemented his strengths until the mid-70s. And with The Cars, he was born in Baltimore, but kind of first really kind of came on the scene when the family moved to Ohio, and he had bounced around Ohio for a bit playing in sort of bar bands and, you know, sort of dabbling, learning, being, I think he mentioned that like his first instrument might have been the drums. And When he met Benjamin Orr, who was a Cleveland native, the two of them really coalesced and kind of formed the core of the band, and eventually gathering the rest of the quintet and moving to Boston. And it was Boston in the mid-70s where they really sort of kind of began to make a name for themselves and kind of caught the ear of record labels and producers.
Although the Cars, I just associate with the 80s. New wave.
Yeah.
Kind of a reaction to punk because it was all poppy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is really the surprising thing, because he is of a generation, you know, whether it's 75 or 70, it doesn't matter. It's still, he's kind of just a few years younger than, you know, people like Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really sort of was of a generation that, you know, had the chance to see the Beatles perform live, kind of a thing, you know. But when he did kind of make his first marks as a musician, he was doing it in a totally new idiom that we, you're right, so totally associate with New Wave, and something that is not, you know, first generation rock and roll, but, you know, several decades into the art form. That ability to create sort of timeless music is actually one of the band's strengths.
And hit after hit after hit they created. Let's hear one of them. It's called My Best Friend's Girl. Eric, it just sounds like the 50s, too, in a way.
I mean, there is a certain sort of Roy Orbison timbre to his voice, with that little kind of warble that sort of kicks in there. But then with the keyboards, it's actually, you know, one person that deserves a bit of credit that kind of gets overlooked is their producer, Roy Thomas Baker, who kind of polished them up into this gleaming new wave sort of juggernaut. And he was certainly a generation and a half older than most of the bands that we normally think of as new wave bands coming out of the late 70s and early 80s. But it was just the ability to, like I say, sort of this timelessness. He sort of incorporated all of the different relevant elements of music, taking what was going on at the time. Working within the idiom, if you had to sort of narrow it down to a specific, it was power pop.
Yeah.
And that is sort of a bit of a an unusual category of music, because it's never truly been the main kind of chart-topping kind of music.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you hear about them as part of the MTV generation. So they were really there when MTV started.
You know, one of the most important events in early MTV history was the 1984 MTV Video Music Awards. This is sort of the year that you had, you know, Michael Jackson was sort of a big deal. And I mean, he'd always been a big deal, I suppose, but sort of the height of his fame. And you had the art form really getting some attention for the first time. The Cars won most of the major awards that year for their single You Might Think, which was important in terms of sort of computer graphics. I don't know if you'll recall it, but it features Rick Ocasek being sort of morphed into like a fly that is sort of buzzing around this pretty girl.
With his head
exactly.
The fly body.
And, you know, it looks, particularly from this vantage point in the 21st century, it looks extremely primitive. But at the time, that was sort of a breakthrough in computer graphics. And that video became one of MTV's, you know, most favorite videos to play during that era, for sure.
Okay, here's a bit of You Might Think.
You might think I'm crazy. Come hang around with you. Maybe I think I'm lucky. That's something to do. But I think that you're wild. Inside me is some child.
You Might Think, sung by Rick Ocasek, who also wrote that song, right?
He
lyrics,
did.
Yep. Music, all of it.
Yep.
And played the fly in the video.
Yep.
And then he went on after the Cars broke up to be a big producer.
Correct. He, I mean, I'm not even sure you would describe him as a big producer, but he produced some important records and really kind of marked some certain bands that kind of later went on to some great stardom, Weezer being sort of the key example. And that's another example of a band that was a little bit out of their element. They were power pop for that generation in the 90s. And sort of competing up against the grunge sounds that were sort of more popular at the time, although it should be noted that Kurt Cobain would regularly cover the Cars in concert. You know, he worked with Jonathan Richmond on one of his albums, and that kind of, I think, goes back to their days being working the Boston music scene, because Jonathan Richmond was there. But he also had an affinity for L.A. bands. He worked with No Doubt on a number of songs. He also produced an album from a local band, Possum Dixon. And so he was clearly, you know, engaged with the music scene. He released a number of solo records. They never did a whole heck of a lot, but he did also admit that he just really hated touring. And so he was happy just sort of, you know, working with bands that he liked and enjoying his time. And the recognition in 2018 of, you know, finally getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, mind you, with a band that never had a number one hit single. They had plenty of top 10 singles, but never a number one or never a number one album for that matter. But a band whose legacy is fully intact. And like I say, it's that timeless quality there to their music that really strikes me.
KCRW DJ, music critic, Eric J. Lawrence. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Matt.
Let the story be told. Let them say what they want. Let the photos be old. Let them show what they want. Let them leave you up in the air. Let them brush your rock and roll hair. Let the good times roll.
Okay, you can let the good times roll. Keep rolling here on KCRW by keeping us alive and becoming a member of KCRW during our UnDrive. It's our last week, so now's your last chance, really, to do that. We have so many reasons for you to go online at kcrw.com/join. Number one is you love KCRW, so reason enough. kcrw.com/join. I'll see you tomorrow.